TED Audio Collective.
Welcome to the TED Interview. I'm your host, Stephen Johnson. This is a show where we wrestle with big, profound questions like, where is the artificial intelligence revolution going to take us? Or how can we reinvent our work routines in the post-COVID age? This week's guest happens to be a world-renowned expert in answering questions. Questions that revolve around the fundamental laws of physics and the nature of reality itself. In fact, his question-answering skill is so celebrated that people all over the world have been sending him questions over the internet for more than a decade now. Questions like, what would happen if you shrunk Jupiter down to the size of a house and placed it in a neighborhood? What would happen if you microwaved a smaller microwave oven? If you put a million hungry ants in a glass cube with a human, who's more likely to walk out alive? Now, what I love about our guest, Randall Munroe, is not just the fact that he actually does the work to figure out the answers to these improbable queries in best-selling books like What If? And his latest, What If 2? But he also manages to craft those answers into ingenious illustrated essays that are both hilarious and surprisingly enlightening. Originally a robotics engineer, Munroe is the creator of the classic Hugo Award-winning internet comic XKCD. In addition to his two What If books, he's also the author of How To. In this conversation, Randall and I explored some of the most intriguing scenarios from the new What If volume, and we discussed how contemplating these absurdist thought experiments actually helps us understand the world. That's next on the TED Interview.
Ever wish you could look around the corner to make sense of today's big business and social issues and prepare for what's coming tomorrow? Dozens of podcasts promise to bring you the latest news and the latest trends. But where's the so what? Why does it matter? And what does it all mean for you? BCG's flagship podcast, The So What from BCG, features award-winning British journalist Georgie Frost, interviewing BCG's leading thinkers and doers to get you the answers you want and need. Hear the ideas that are shaping and disrupting the future. This is not your typical business strategy podcast. Listen to The So What from BCG wherever you get your podcasts. You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Randall Munroe, welcome to the TED Interview.
Hey, no, thanks so much for having me.
First off, congratulations on the new book. It is a delight. As all your work is. I wanted to start by taking a step back and talking about the arc of your career. I mean, one way to describe what you do for a living, at least with the What If Project, is that people from all around the world send you crazy hypothetical scenarios, and you spend your time figuring out how they would actually work in practice. And that is, to put it mildly, not a traditional career path. How did you get to that as a career?
Well, so I started drawing comics originally about a bunch of sort of science-y topics. So I would draw comics about whatever I was interested in, and I started posting them online and then was kind of surprised to discover that there were a bunch of other people out there who thought the same stuff was funny that I did and were into the same sort of niche science topics, etc. And so that was really fun. But one of the unexpected consequences was that people would start sending me questions that they had, often like, you know, something they'd been debating with their friends or they'd been wondering about. And there was always a little bit of a subtext to those emails that was like, we have this question, but we think it's like not a good or important enough question to bother a real scientist who has important stuff to do. But we talked about it. We agreed. You seemed like you'd be a great person to answer it. And I wasn't sure if I should be a little bit offended. Like, you know, what are you saying? I don't have anything better to do than sit around and research questions, you know, but they were also 100% right. So I would get these emails and I would like immediately, like it would derail my whole day because I would be like, well, now I want to know this, the answer to this question too. And I would start, okay, well, I bet I could look it up this way. No, I can't figure it out there. Okay, maybe I can calculate it this way. First, I just need to dig up the textbook where I had that information. And then like 6 hours have gone by and I'm like surrounded by like papers. I have 100 tabs open in my browser of PDFs. And then I'm like, this is more effort than I maybe should have put into an email. But, you know, I was really proud of myself. And then I was, after doing several of these, I was like, hey, maybe I should post these somewhere. Like, maybe other people would want to read this, like, enormous amount of research. Because I also imagine the person who sent it sort of got it, like, a one-line question to me. And then they get back this essay. And they're like, oh, thanks. Cool. I will mark this to read, you know.
So there was something in the original XKCD comic series that suggested to your audience that you would be a good answerer of crazy questions about how the world works?
Yeah, I think probably a combination of like I would talk about science topics now and then where I would, you know, mention some fairly obscure detail and it would make people assume that I knew everything about all of the fields I was writing about, which is absolutely not true. But I also often drew comics about like my tendency to really overthink things and to like dive into pointless questions like, hey, what's the most optimal way to walk from this side of campus to the other, you know, where there's this place where you can walk across the grass and this place where there's this angle of pathway. Okay, you have to do trigonometry, you know. And people are like, oh, I guess he seems to enjoy overthinking this stuff.
So let's get into some of these scenarios from the new book, from What If 2. I picked a few out here that I thought were particularly entertaining. So the first one is near the beginning of the book, and I'm just going to read. This is the question that came into you. If one were to stand on top of the Old Faithful geyser in Yellowstone National Park, at what speed would you be launched upward by the water, and what injuries would you likely sustain? Don't try this at home on your family vacation. Obviously, we start with that caveat. But beyond that, what is the answer to this?
Well, this is really my favorite kind of question is one where, like, I think I know the answer when I hear it, but I'm not sure. Because, like, when I heard this, I was like, well, of course, you'd die probably. Like, you'd definitely get burned, right? But then I start second-guessing myself because I'm like, wait a minute. It's the jet that comes out of Yellowstone. I know it's caused by heat underground. But is it actually hot water when it comes out? I realize there are all these questions, you know, like how dense is it? Is it like a jet of water or is it just like steam? And I realize this is a tricky problem. Could it lift a person out off the ground? I don't know. Yeah. And so I did a bunch of calculations. The first thing I learned is, yes, it would be very bad. It is very hot. It's very fast moving. If it hit you right, it could certainly fling you into the air, possibly higher than the geyser itself if you managed to, like, catch enough of it, you know, with maybe you were holding an umbrella or something. And what I also learned, though, was that sort of to my surprise, no one has been killed by the geyser at Old Faithful. I found this great book by a park historian. It was like Death in Yellowstone and all the different dangers and deaths that people encounter when they're there. So I was surprised. No one has died from the geyser at Yellowstone. Lots of people have been severely burned by leaning over and trying to look into it and having it erupt. But most of them have just sort of gotten you see the steam starting to come up and you probably flinch.
Right.
At least one person, I think in the 1920s, did fall into the crevice where the steam comes out. There's sort of a bathtub-sized depression there. Mm. But I think he managed to get out and relatively, alive at least. But what I learned was they're really strict about having people, they've gotten better about, you know, making sure people don't go walking up to the geyser. And the big reason not to walk up to the geyser is the area around it, which is much more deadly, because you'll get these boiling pools with a thin mineral crust over them. So it's sort of like a creme brulee, and you're walking and it just looks like solid ground, and suddenly, you know, crack, and you like plunge through into boiling water. So I came out of that chapter with a real respect for, like, when they put up signs that are like, stay on the boardwalk as you're walking around here, really stay on the boardwalk.
Just to answer the original question, how high up in the air you would potentially get higher than the actual geyser if you positioned yourself exactly right?
Yeah. I think because the geyser, it comes out at a really high speeds, you know, not the speed of sound, but certainly fast. And the geyser, I think, tops out, you know, it depends on the specific eruption, but it might get, you know, 50 meters, something like that. But it slows down because of the drag of the air. It's like if you spray a spray bottle, it's very fast when it comes out of the nozzle, but it slows down right away when it hits the air. But a person who's small and dense, if you got kicked up to speed by the initial impact of the water, you could get flung much higher.
This next one I thought was interesting on a couple levels. It involves a story that I had not heard about, which was kind of bizarre in the first place. But I also love where you took it in terms of answering the question. And so the actual question, and hopefully you can explain the backstory to this, is what if Au Bon Pain, the chain of kind of upscale fast food restaurants, I guess you would say, what if they lost their 2014 lawsuit and had to pay the plaintiff $2 undecillion? That was the question. Am I pronouncing it right? Undecillion?
I have never run into a person in real life who's used that word, so your guess is as good as mine.
For all intents and purposes, it's how we pronounce it. So that is a number that has just a massive number of zeros.
Yeah, it's a
it.
2 with, I think, 36 zeros after it.
Right. I like, by the way, that they asked for 2 undecillion.
Maybe it was one for like the one time they got their order wrong, and then they're like, oh, but then they got it wrong a second time. That's another undecillion.
What the heck is going on with this story?
Well, this sort of highlights a maybe underappreciated aspect about our legal system, which is that anyone can file a lawsuit about anything. It doesn't have to be reasonable or even involve numbers that are remotely connected to reality. So you can file a lawsuit for this, which might have just been like the largest number the plaintiff could look up. The lawsuit was pretty quickly thrown out by a judge. But a lawyer who wrote about it wrote to me and was like, so what if they actually did have to pay this? And what's funny is that the amount of money being sued for here is much bigger than the amount of money in the world. And sometimes when we talk about really big numbers, it can sort of blur together. Like, people will frequently mix up a million and a billion. I do this. I have trouble with the words sometimes. But they are very different. They're like different by a factor of 1,000. And these big numbers all kind of blur together. Like, oh, it's a million trillion. Is that really that much bigger than 1,000 billion? You know?
Right.
But so what I sometimes like to do is, instead of using scientific notation, just like write out the whole number. And if you write out the amount of money with all the zeros that they're being sued for, you know, it might take up most of the page.
I think it's a wonderful exercise, though, in just trying to calculate what these kinds of numbers would really mean in practice. And you ran through a couple of exercises trying to explain how much money exactly that would be. Can you walk us through where you ended up with that?
Yeah. So you write out this number with the 30-odd zeros after it on the paper. You can then write other numbers under it and just be like, how wide is this number? You know, how many zeros are there? Which sort of feels like a like fake way to do math, but it sort of makes sense. It's sort of equivalent to working on logarithmic scales. And so I wrote out like the total amount, the value of all goods and services in the world, which was an estimate I had calculated a while ago for a chart I made. And then the value of all goods and services produced by humanity since we first evolved. And that's also, the number isn't even half as many zeros. You know, it's not even half as long. And so I worked out that, like, even if Au Bon Pain conquered the planet and put everyone to work from now until the death of the last stars, they would not make a dent in the bill in terms of the value. And so I tried to figure out all these things, like, what if you sold the whole planet for scrap? Which parts of the Earth are most valuable if you, like, could shred it? Weirdly, the potassium and calcium ended up being the most valuable parts just because there's so much of them. Of course, you'd pretty quickly, like, crash the market for potassium and calcium. But look, we don't have a lot of options here if we need this much money. And so what I eventually just concluded, like, paying this settlement is, like, impossible, and not just, you know, practically impossible. It's, like, impossible in almost any sense of the word you can come up with.
This next one actually is one of my favorite questions. It may be my favorite question in the book, actually, because it, I think it's a great reminder of the crazy run of technological progress and kind of Moore's Law that we've been on with computers over the last 70, 80 years or so. So the question is, what if my phone, presumably a, you know, smartphone, Android phone, iPhone, was based on vacuum tubes? You know, the earlier technology that the first computers in the 40s and 50s were based on. How big would the phone be?
I love this question, too. It's fun to think about because it is, in a sense, possible. One of the one of the really neat and fundamental things about electronics is, like, and about computing, is that once you have a minimal set of operations, like you have a circuit or a set of switches that can do some basic pieces of math, then with that, you can build a computer that can solve any problem that any other computer can. It just might take more time or memory. And so using vacuum tubes, you can build the same fundamental circuits that we build nowadays in our phones with chips that have these, you know, billions of transistors on them. It's just going to be much bigger, take much more power, and be much slower. So I worked out, I looked at, like, the vacuum tubes they used in ENIAC and UNIVAC, some of those early room-sized computers, and figured out if you tried to do a modern iPhone, it would take up a couple of city blocks. and it depends on whether you assume you can use all the other modern stuff for, like, the, you know, power and the other components that they had. But the problem you would have would be heat, because the vacuum tubes take a lot of power and they produce a lot of heat. And so if you put that many of them together in one place, you wouldn't be able to get the heat away from them quickly. The phone is going to heat up to the point where it's glowing and, like, melting its way through the Earth's surface. So Amazing. You need a protective case for your phone, but, like, not to protect the phone, to protect the ground if you drop it.
It's a great reminder of, like, how important heat management is in the modern tech world.
And still is. The other thing that I did while I was working on this is I thought, oh, well, what about the reverse problem? How small could you make UNIVAC now? You know, it used to be this big, you know, thing that took up most of a room. And I realized you could make, if you just scale it down in the same way, you know, assume you're making it the same shape, but it has transistors in place of vacuum tubes, you could make a UNIVAC that's embedded in a grain of salt. I love that mental image of, like, salt fortified with UNIVAC.
The vacuum tube question actually reminded me of a story you told in a TED Talk you did a few years ago that I think is based on a scenario from the first version of What If, which involves Google and punch cards.
Yeah. So the question was, if Google, sort of similar to the vacuum tube question, you know, if Google wanted to use punch cards, which is what they used to use to store digital information, to store all the stuff they currently have in their data centers on hard drives, magnetic tape, and so on, how much space they would need. And the answer, again, is, like, you know, more space than anyone has. You know, it would, like, cover the whole country up to a fairly deep depth of punch cards. But in order to answer that question, I had to sort of estimate how much data Google has. And that turned out to be something they did not publish. So I tried a bunch of different ways of estimating it. And, you know, I looked at, like, okay, what's the global hard drive market? What percentage of that do we think Google could conceivably be, you know, make up? How many data centers do they have? How much room is there in them? How much power do they typically use? And I eventually came up with an estimate that I felt like, okay, this is good enough. I stand by this. I think it's at least, you know, within an order of magnitude of the correct answer. So I put it in my answer. Google, of course, you know, refuses to share any of this information. But in response, they did send me a series of punch cards that I thought, oh, that's a nice souvenir. Of course, they wouldn't tell me anything. But I'm like, oh, but they have these punch cards. Hey, I should try to read these. And I read them, and there was a code on them. And, you know, I got some friends to help. We, like, worked through the punch cards. You had to put them all together, overlay them, do these clever things. And I finally decoded it to get the secret message Google was going to share with me. And the message was, no comment. But I stand by my estimate. I think it was about right at the time I did it.
Secretive, but with a sense of humor. So I want to take a step back and think about these questions in general. There was one that struck me as indicative of something that I think is really interesting about the questions that you receive. And it was less about the question, it was more about the comment about it. So someone wrote in and said, can all the world's bananas fit inside all of the world's churches? And then they followed up by saying, my friends have had this argument for a little over 10 years now. So there's this friend group that has been sitting there debating this, you know, presumably like predating, you know, the original publication of What If. So this is not a Randall Munroe kind of question that they gravitated to. They somehow got to this question on their own. And they've been debating it for this much time. And that to me is kind of lovely, that people stumble onto these thought experiments and spend so much time. But are you surprised at the amount of cognitive labor that people are putting into these kinds of questions?
No, I mean, I think people in general are, you know, they like asking questions. They're curious about things. I find that sometimes the best questions come from little kids. And occasionally people will suggest, oh, yeah, it's because little kids are innately curious and adults have lost their curiosity. And I don't really think that's it. I think maybe adults feel more like they're supposed to know. And if they don't know, there's some reason they don't know. And so, like, it makes them, like, nervous about asking or feel like they don't know who to ask. And so I really enjoy getting these questions and enjoy showing, like, here's how these tools of calculation can help to answer them, just to try to encourage people to be like, no, these are answerable questions. It's okay that you wonder about these. You can talk to other people. Like, I'm really glad this person had a friend group where they were comfortable going back and forth and talking about this. I really enjoy that.
It just, you know, it suggests to me that before you came along, the world was filled with people who were having these kinds of debates with their friends, and they didn't have anywhere to pose these questions officially. I mean, presumably that, you know, if this isn't, this kind of curiosity was always there, latent in the population, but there just was not a place to kind of think out loud in public about these kinds of questions. And so you have satisfied a long unmet need in the population with this series. I think it's a really important service.
Yeah, and I do think it's really helpful because, you know, if the question is important to something, then eventually you'll find, you know, someone will find a venue where it's appropriate. Like if it's a question about how to build a better car, someone at a car company will eventually ask it, you know. But what I like is the same tools that you use to answer serious, important questions can be used on these kinds of silly questions and vice versa. And so I like using these questions that everyone has that there's no clear answer to out there to illustrate how we can use the tools of science and math to actually get answers and not just have to argue with our friends forever.
Have you discerned kind of patterns in the kinds of questions you get over time? You know, is there a kind of typology of what if questions that you think about?
Yeah, I think one thing that stands out is it can be fun when a question that sounds kind of straightforward and mundane ends up having like these catastrophic consequences. if you ask about anything moving at the speed of light, or, you know, what if you gathered some astronomical thing on some human scale, often you end up with like, well, that would destroy the Earth, or that would, you know, demolish your city, or that would, you know, have some consequence like that. And so I found sometimes people ask questions where they're clearly like trying to come up with a scenario that will be as destructive and catastrophic as possible. But what's funny to me is that often those end up being less catastrophic and destructive than like very straightforward questions from little kids. One of my favorites that's in the new book is there was a little girl who asked, her father sent it in because she said she wanted to build a billion-story building. And like, I think I got that, you know, that same day I read through a bunch of questions about like, what if you put a nuclear bomb on a train going at, you know, 90% of the speed of light and then crashed into a volcano? And it like sounds very destructive. And the billion story building is like a better question because it's a real straightforward, simple question that is also ultimately like a lot more destructive. Because if you build something a billion stories tall in Earth's gravity, it will not be stable. And when it breaks apart and collapses, it will not be great for people on Earth. Like the Amazing. Volcano, at least, would only be bad for the people in its vicinity. But having pieces of a building enter the Earth's atmosphere all around the planet can be pretty bad for a lot of people.
Amazing. There's another question that I thought was striking in the way that you began your answer to it, which is, the question was, has humanity produced enough paint to cover the entire land area of the Earth? But what I thought was striking about it was you begin your answer by talking about what's called the Fermi estimation, which is after the physicist Enrico Fermi, which is something that, as I recall, that Carl Sagan was really interested in as well, which is kind of performing rough order of magnitude calculations almost off the top of your head. You talk about how important that is as a kind of mental module to have. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, this is a sort of, it's a skill that, like, you know, it's a tool that it doesn't fit neatly into any one area of science, but it's like really useful in all of them, which is like trying to get a very rough idea of the scale of numbers involved in something. There's a quote from the statistician John Tukey that I really like. It's something like, it's far better to have an approximate answer to the right question, which might be vague, than an exact answer to the wrong question, which can always be made precise. So it's like often when people get questions, they'll try to rephrase the question into something that can be precisely answered or looked up, and then look up that answer, and then, you know, say, okay, well, here's the answer. But that step where you rephrase it into something that can be looked up might be like where you're losing all of what's important. And sometimes you'll get that answer and then you'll be like, wait, but if we apply that answer to the original question, it clearly can't be, you know, it doesn't make sense. And so I like trying to get approximate answers. I think that's really useful. You know, and this applies to, for example, the painting the Earth. Like the way I started with that one was supposing that, well, okay, I live in a room, I have another room. Let's just assume everyone in the world has two rooms and they need to cover them both with paint. Well, that's like if a room is about 50 square meters of area, the two rooms is 100. You know, you've got 8 billion people, 100 square meters per person. That's like, you know, a little under a trillion square meters. And that's much smaller than the Earth. So if that's how much paint we have, enough for everyone to paint two rooms, then that suggests there's not nearly enough. You can come at it from another direction, though, because that's not certain. Maybe there's enough paint for every person to paint like 20 rooms, because you have to paint outsides, you have to paint cars, you have to paint other stuff, like other stuff I'm probably not thinking of. Or maybe there doesn't exist that much paint in the world, and if we all suddenly tried to repaint our rooms, the world would run out of paint. But then we can try coming at it from other directions. Okay, what about how much paint do they stock at stores? Like if I went in and wanted to paint my house, maybe you need about 20 gallons of paint. Sounds about right. And if you do math out, figuring out how many houses there are, how many gallons of paint that would be, you come up with an estimate that's sort of similar to the first one. It says there's not enough paint. And so I finally found a global paint industry report. and figured out how much paint they produce, how quickly is the paint market growing, and came up with an estimate of like the total amount of paint that's been produced in the world. And it came up with, it was sort of in between all of those those three Fermi estimates I came up with. It was like, there's not enough to cover the Earth, but there's enough to cover, I came up with roughly the area of like the US or Canada. Those first estimates, there were a whole bunch of like numbers in there that are probably wrong. You know, my idea of how long it takes to paint a house might be wrong, or, you know, how many cans of paint it takes to cover a room or whatever. But they don't need to be that right to tell you, like, if the number is 100 times bigger than the area of the Earth, then there probably is enough paint. And if it's 100 times smaller, there probably isn't. Because, like, on average, your mistakes kind of tend to cancel out. Like, maybe one estimate is too big, but the other estimate is too small. And then when you multiply them together, you come up with something that's, if not exactly right, at least sort of in the neighborhood.
One of the things I noticed as a parent when my kids, particularly when they were kind of in middle school, was that that differed from the kind of education that I had, in particularly in math, was that they were specifically taught techniques for making guesstimates at things. So instead of being like, okay, this is how you calculate the exact answer down to 9 decimal places, they would be taught, in addition to that, this is how you can quickly, in your head, come up with a rough estimate of what this is, you know, that's not exactly precise, but probably pretty accurate. And I thought, that's an amazing advance, because that's what you need most of the time. Most of the time, you're just sitting there trying to do a rough calculation of something like, well, if I did this at this many hours, it'd be roughly $800. You know, okay, give or take. And so teaching those skills is really important, I think.
Yeah, and a lot of the time, I feel like even an approximate answer, you don't necessarily need to know the answer, you just need to know, is it definitely smaller than this other number? Mm-hmm. If it is, I don't care what the answer is. You know, like, how much will this cost? I don't know, but if it's definitely way more than the amount of money I have, I don't need to figure out if it's $1 billion or $1 trillion. I know it's outside my budget. And so, yeah, that kind of approximation is really useful. And I'm really happy to hear when, you know, that it's being taught.
Beyond those Fermi estimations, what do you think people are getting kind of cognitively or intellectually out of these exercises?
I don't know. It was neat to see that when I started posting them, people started sending me more questions. I also saw people who would mention that a question came up and one of them suggested, you know, oh, hey, let's send it to the what if guy. And I found that really encouraging, because I think it made people feel more like this might be answerable. And that's really what I like encouraging, is people to understand that, like, it's okay if you don't know the answers to things. It's possible to figure them out. And I really like kind of the distinction between, there's stuff you can argue about forever that doesn't really have an answer. Like, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Is a hot dog a sandwich? You know, these questions, you might be able to come up with answers in one way or another. Like, the hot dog sandwich thing has been, there was at least one lawsuit that rested on whether a taco was a sandwich, I think. But like, you'll get the answer that's like that person's answer. But there's something like less satisfying about that. Like, whereas there other questions really do have answers. Like, we might not know what they are. We might not be able to figure them out easily, but you really can get an answer and be like, this is what would happen. Mm-hmm. And then you can try it and see if it's right, you know?
Right.
And I really like moving some things from the realm of like, oh, well, I've always wondered about this and I'm sure different people would give different answers and who knows, to like, no, I can be sort of confident that like, this is the correct answer. This is what would happen. And so like moving more stuff from the realm of frustrating semantic arguments to like cool facts about the universe is something that I find really satisfying, and I sort of hope other people do too.
Well, Randall Monroe, thank you so much for joining us. You know, it's been great to hear your answers to some of these questions, and I'm sure our listeners have now come up with their own long list of questions that they're going to bombard you with. And so look out in your inbox. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you. It's great to chat with you.
That's it for the show today. The TED interview is part of the TED Audio Collective. This episode was produced by our managing producer, Wilson Sayre, and mixed by Erica Wong. Jimmy Gutierrez is our story editor, fact-checking by Hannah Matsudaira. Faraday Grunge is our project manager, and Dan O'Donnell is our executive producer. Special thanks to Constanza Gallardo, Michelle Quint, Anna Phelan. I'm your host, Stephen Johnson. For more info about my other projects, including my latest book, which is about to come out in a young reader edition, Extra Life, you can follow me on Twitter at Stephen B. Johnson or sign up for my Substack newsletter, Adjacent Possible.